The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Parents in the comfortable West find themselves caught in a double bind. While scientific research into diet, relationships, and cognitive development turns parenthood into just another technical discipline, a process that can be mastered or dismally failed, the instant connectivity of modern life feeds us a constant drip of stranger danger, medical scare stories, and a terrifying cavalcade of horrific abuse. How do we keep our children safe? Kate Hamer explores our primal fears with a novel of disappearance, The Girl in the Red Coat, a modern fairy tale which charts an unexpected journey through the maze of dangers surrounding children in the 21st century. But first, we welcome Eula Biss, who won an NBCC award in 2010 for her collection of essays on race in America, Notes from No Man's Land. With measles outbreaks reported currently in 17 US states, her latest book, On Immunity, enters similarly contested territory. When she spoke down the line from Chicago, she began by explaining how she began writing about inoculation.
So my interest began as a personal interest. I was pregnant with my son. This was 6 years ago now. And I'd heard some murmurings about vaccination, but I didn't know anything about it. And I decided that I would look into it a little further before it was time for me to vaccinate my son, which in the U.S., the first vaccine is scheduled for 12 hours after birth. So I knew I had to try to figure this out before he was born. And the reading that I started then when I was pregnant continued on and on. It continued well after my son was born, well after he'd been vaccinated. I found that this subject is really much more expansive than I initially thought it was. I found myself reading anthropology and history and environmental literature and reading about politics. So I found that the subject went far beyond my personal questions into these larger questions of citizenship, actually. And that's how I found myself writing a book.
It's not only, as you say, very rich, but also very deeply polarized. It's a kind of very emotional debate.
Yes, yes, increasingly so. You know, my last book was about race and racism, and that's another very polarized and polarizing space. And I think that there's something I'm actually attracted to as a writer about these spaces, where I feel there's an opportunity for more complex thought in between those two poles. So that actually was part of my interest in this, was to see what could be said that was more complicated than what ends up being said on either end of those poles.
The personal engagement that you began with is kind of written into the structure of the book. We hear about your son's early life, your discussions with your father, your sister, even conversations you have with mothers of young children around you. I'm wondering if this personal testimony gives you a certain kind of authority. I mean, it's a different kind of authority, perhaps, to all the research you've done in medical journals and news archives and so on, but it's maybe an authority that's necessary to get you a hearing with people who are kind of worried about vaccination.
Yeah, you know, one of the things this book is about is ways of knowing. And I wanted to, in this book, honor the fact that there's many different ways of knowing and coming to knowledge. And yes, there's research and reading, and I participated in that way of knowing and coming to knowledge. But there's also personal relationships and personal experience, and that's another very legitimate way of coming into knowledge. And I actually saw that when I was interviewing epidemiologists and immunologists and pediatricians. What was interesting to me was noticing that they were actually drawing on a variety of different ways of knowing as well. For instance, I was interviewing a very well-known immunologist who invented a vaccine. He was talking to me about having recently treated two children who were very, very ill with influenza, and one of the children died. And he became very, very emotional when he was talking to me about this. And I could see that his investment in this issue was not just as a scientist or as someone who had done research in this area. It was also as a person who cared about the lives of other people. And having seen a child struggle with influenza and die from it was a very different kind of knowing for him than what he'd seen in his research and his training.
Do you worry that this kind of personal engagement leaves an argument open to personal attack?
Yeah, I knew that that was the danger of writing this way, and that has happened to some extent. I knew it would. That's one of the hazards of writing this way.
You just take it on the chin because it offers you another option. It offers you a different way of approaching the subject.
In some areas, it offers me the best way of discussing the subject. So, for instance, there's a moment in the book that I didn't want to write, and that's a moment where I discuss my son's surgery. He had surgery to have his adenoids removed. And this was a very minor surgery, but very emotional for me, very hard decision for me to make. And the surgery went very well, but I had a lot of conflict with the anesthesiologist. And it remained a very kind of raw and difficult memory for me. I very much didn't want to write about that in this book, and my editor and I discussed it at some length, in part because I didn't feel very settled about that experience, and I didn't want to open myself up to being critiqued on something that I didn't yet feel comfortable with. But the reason it's in there, the reason I did write it, is not just because my editor and also a close friend of mine who's a good reader encouraged it, but because it was the best way for me to talk about the conundrum of paternalism in medicine. And I think it's a very complicated subject where, to some degree, we need a certain amount of paternalism. On the other hand, it doesn't feel good to be the subject of paternalism. And that moment of my son's surgery was, I thought, the best illustration that I could think of that problem, that conundrum.
The book's constructed as an accumulation of smaller pieces, each one of which takes a few pages to arrive at a certain point to take the argument on a little. Is this kind of multi-directional approach another way of avoiding this kind of top-down lecturing position?
You know, that might be the effect, and I've never thought of it that way, and that certainly might be the effect. Part of why the book is written that way is because I found this issue to be so multifaceted, and I wanted a structure that would allow me to talk about the issue from a lot of different directions. So there's a short section that talks about the history of sexism in the medical establishment. And then there's a short section that talks about the international politics of polio. There's a short section that talks about capitalism. And any one of those sections could actually probably be expanded into a whole book. But I wanted to, one of the things I wanted to do in this book was reveal how complicated this terrain is. And that's part of why it becomes so intense and emotional for people, right? Because it's involving a lot of different issues. It's involving people's feelings about government and people's feelings about bad experiences with medicine and all kinds of other freighted material. So I really wanted to touch on as many parts of this as I could to give a reader a better sense of what all is going into the intensity behind this debate.
One of the reasons why this debate is, as you put it, so intense is because we're just not very good at dealing with defeasible scientific certainty, are we? I mean, how can we deal better with that idea that science is this self-correcting discipline, that scientists can never be certain, but they can certainly be pretty darn sure?
Yeah. You know, one of the interesting things about this debate is that it's a social debate that centers around a place where scientists have an unusual degree of consensus. So almost any other area of medicine that you wanted to look at, you'd find less consensus than there is in this area. And even so, as you say, there's still more uncertainty than many people are comfortable with. I think our expectations of science are, in many cases, impossible for scientists to live up to. Sometimes we want scientists to occupy this kind of godlike role where they know everything and can declare certainty in areas where no mortal could actually have certainty. And one of the humbling things about writing this book was talking to so many scientists, interviewing so many scientists, and seeing how well acquainted they are with their own limit as thinkers and as researchers, and how aware they are of what isn't known and what at this moment can't be known. And I think that's difficult for us lay people to accept, that there's things that at this moment can't be known.
When we're confronted with this gap between this godlike knowledge we'd like and the kind of caveats that we actually get, the temptation is always to plump for some position somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, and you know, that was my impulse. As I was saying earlier in this conversation, initially I entered this because I did think that I could find some centrist position, something in the middle that would be a kind of compromise between the two extremes that I was seeing. And part of what happened was quite surprising to me, in that the more I researched, the more I began to believe that what is sometimes seen as the extreme position of following the vaccination schedule that the government lays out to the T ceased to strike me as extreme. The more I read, the more I learned. And, you know, there are a variety of people in this country who've profited off of positioning themselves as the compromise position between vaccinating and not vaccinating. So best known in this country is Dr. Bob Sears. And he wrote a book about vaccines where he suggests an alternative schedule that's in some ways a compromise between the CDC schedule and not vaccinating, and that it uses all the same vaccines but spaced out over time. And a lot of people are attracted to this because I think people want to find a space that feels reasonable. The thing that I think is dangerous about that in this case is that the middle ground between reliable information and unreliable information is still unreliable information. So there's some things that shouldn't be averaged out, in other words. And there's even a logical fallacy named after this phenomenon. I think it's called the gray area fallacy, where choosing a position between two extremes doesn't necessarily put you in a position of truth. And I think that that's what I found most surprising and maybe even disturbing as I researched this more and more, was that I think the rhetoric around this debate has suggested to us that a position that is actually quite conservative and prudent, which is vaccinating on schedule, has somehow come to seem to us as extreme and as unusually aggressive.
This is a kind of very timely, very important issue. Is the problem really that C.P. Snow's idea of two cultures, the idea that it's okay for someone in the 21st century to treat scientific knowledge as a kind of something I don't have to know about, is that really what's at stake here?
I'm not sure. My impulse is to say that I think this is less about scientific knowledge than it is about other things. And it's confusing because when this is debated in the media and even in person, when I talk to other mothers, the language we use is the language of science, and the arguments we use are often arguments that are based in scientific knowledge or data or evidence. But what is being argued about is not, in my estimation, science. I think we're arguing about, in some cases, the individual's relationship with the collective. And so this kind of grand question of what do we owe the people around us? So there's an argument happening there. And there are also arguments happening around trust. And I hear a lot of other parents saying, having seen what I've seen, why should I trust the government? Why should I trust doctors? Why should I trust pharmaceutical companies? And to some degree, I feel some empathy with that. I think that there's good reasons to feel skeptical of the government and of pharmaceutical companies and of the medical establishment. That said, I don't think that means that we should refuse a technology that makes other people's lives better.
So what you mean is that if you want to address the problem with vaccination, this kind of what seems a straightforwardly kind of medical problem, you have to address the wider culture of fear within which we're operating.
I think so, yes. And I think there's several different parts of that. And you call it a culture of fear, and I think that's very fair to say. I think that fear is, in this moment, really supported and treasured and encouraged culturally. And that is, I think, quite dangerous. And specifically within parenting culture, the parenting culture of this moment, at least the American upper middle class parenting culture, is very attached to fear. And I think that that is part of what needs to be addressed, is where we choose to feel fear and how we choose to treat our fear. So in some cases, we're not going to be able to resist feeling fearful. But I think we still have a choice about what we do with our fear. And then the other part of this is a bigger project, I think, that has to do with the structure of the government. And in this country, our very troubled healthcare system. And I do think we need some reforms in our healthcare system, and we need reforms in terms of how pharmaceutical companies operate in order for people to really be able to trust this system.
This is the biggest story in the world.
We will look back on these times and we will think, what on earth were we doing?
From The Guardian.
This is a story about people, and this is a story about possibility.
It's a story that's eluded us for decades. A topic which The Guardian is now throwing itself wholeheartedly into.
I'd seen how we'd done it on other things.
Climate change. So we're letting you in behind the scenes. Editorial meetings, bids for commissions. You'll hear what works, as well as our mistakes. And along the way, you can judge how we do. Is there a new way to make the world care? The biggest story in the world on The Guardian.
This new year, make a resolution to dust off that big idea. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Ulibis's On Immunity is published in the UK by Fitzcarraldo Editions. Sometimes, as one of Kate Hamer's narrators suggests, we find it easier to think of things as stories, particularly things that frighten us or confuse. When she came into the studio, she pitched us directly into the heart of her novel with a reading which finds 8-year-old Carmel off on a trip with her mother.
For my 8th birthday, I want to go and see a maze. Carmel, what do you know about mazes? Mum says. If I think hard, I can see a folded puzzle in my mind that looks like a brain. I've heard things, I say, and Mum laughs and says okay. We don't have a car, so we go on the bus, just the two of us. The windows are steamed up, so I can't see where we're going. Mum's got on her favourite earrings, which are like bits of glass, except colours sparkle on them when she moves. I'm thinking about my birthday, which was last Thursday, and now it's Saturday, and I'm thinking about how my friend gets cards and presents from her nan, but Mum doesn't talk about her mum and dad, even though they're still alive. I don't mind so much about the cards and presents, but I'd like to know what they look like. Mum, have you got a photo of your mum and dad? Her head shoots round, and the earrings flash pink and yellow lights. I'm not sure. Maybe. Why? I just wonder what they look like sometimes, and if they look like me. It's more than sometimes. You look like your dad, sweetheart. But I'd like to know. She smiles. I'll see what I can do. When we get off the bus, the sky is white, and I'm so excited to see a real maze, I run ahead. We're in this big park, and mist is rolling around in ghost shapes. There's a huge grey house with hundreds of windows that are all looking at us. I can tell Mum's scared of the house, so I growl at it. Sometimes she's scared of everything, Mum. Rivers, roads, cars, planes, what's going to happen and what's not going to happen. But then she laughs and says, I'm such a silly old thing. Now we're at the top of this hill, and I can see the maze below, and it does look like a brain. I think it's really funny I've thought about a brain inside my brain and tried to explain, but I don't do it very well, and I don't think Mum really gets it. But she's nodding and listening anyway, and standing there with her long blue coat, all wet from the grass at the bottom. She says, that's very interesting, Carmel, though I'm not really sure she understood. But Mum always tries to. She doesn't just ignore you like you're a mouse or a bat. So we go in. And I know all of a sudden it's a place I love more than anywhere I've ever been. The green walls are so high, the sky's in a slice above me. And it's like being in a puzzle, but in a forest at the same time. Mum says the trees are called yew and spells it out because I laugh and ask, yew? I run on ahead down the path in the middle where the grass is squashed into a brown strip, and Mum's far behind me now. But it doesn't matter, because I know how mazes work, and that even if I lose her, we'll find each other sooner or later. I carry on round corners, and each place looks the same. Bright red berries pop out of the green walls, and birds fly over my head. Except I don't see them fly from one side of the sky to the other. They're above the high green walls, so I only see them for a second, and then they're gone. I hear someone on the other side of the wall. Carmel, is that you? And I say no, even though I know it's my mum. It doesn't sound quite like her. She says, yes it is, I know it's you because I can see your red tights through the tree. But I don't want to go, so I just slip away quietly. It starts getting dark, but I still feel at home in this place. Now it's more like a forest than a maze. The tops of the trees stretch up, up and away, and get higher, like the dark's making them grow. There's some white flowers gleaming, and once I see a piece of rope hanging from a branch. I think maybe a child like me used it as a swing. It's in the middle of a path, and I go right up to it so my nose is nearly touching the frayed bit at the end, and it twists and turns in the breeze like a worm. Dark green smells are all around, and the birds are singing from the middle of the walls. I decide to lie under a tree to rest on the soft brown earth, because I feel tired and dreamy now. The smell of the earth comes up where I'm squashing it, and it smells dark and sweet. Something brushes across my face, and I think it's an old leaf, because it feels dead and scrapey. The birds don't sound like they're singing now, more like chatting. And the breeze is making the trees rustle. And I hear my mother calling me, but she sounds just like the rustling and the birds, and I know I should answer her, but I don't.
So where did this novel of a disappearance come from? Did you start with the voice of the mother or the voice of the child?
I actually started with an image rather than a voice, and it was of a little girl standing in a forest wearing a red coat, and really knowing that she was lost in some way. And I kind of puzzled on this image for a few weeks. And when I started writing, I was just thinking about it in bed, and I sat up and wrote the first chapter. And the first chapter actually came from her mother rather than her, and she was talking about this terrible loss that she's had.
Which had already happened by then.
Yeah, that's right. So it was quite a surprise, really, because I was expecting to hear from Carmel rather than her mother.
She got in the way.
Yeah. And from then on, it was quite clear that it was something that had to be told in a dual narrative. Because the central relationship is a mother and daughter relationship.
But a relationship broken apart.
Exactly, yeah. You know, very cruelly broken apart. But that still, in all the same, carries on in some way.
So it was very much so it was that image that you started from, and then you worked through the book from that point, or was it more chopped up than that?
I knew quite soon on how it was going to end. I knew the sort of big arcs of the story of what had happened, but I didn't plot everything out minutely, but I had very clear sort of path of
followed
where
those
I
landmarks.
Was going. Yeah, exactly.
I'm
yeah.
wondering, was it easy for you to find the different voices for the child and for the mother, and again, the way that the child's voice develops through the book?
Yeah, I think it was, there were challenges there, definitely. One of the challenges was I didn't want to write a childish voice. I very much didn't want to sort of talk down to Carmel by making her, obviously it's got to be age appropriate, but she's got her own thoughts and ideas and sort of rich perceptions about the world.
She's very sharp in some ways, isn't she?
Yeah.
And very not in others.
Yeah, exactly. So the way I kind of got around that is I thought, well, she's a person that happens to be eight, like her mother happens to be a certain age. And the other challenge, I think, was getting the balance between the two, so it's not too weighted. I didn't find it so hard to differentiate between them. That seemed to happen reasonably naturally.
They were fairly clear in your mind in the way that they spoke, the way they held themselves.
And it was quite different as well. With Beth, I always had the sense, and it's told in the past tense, Beth, I always had the sense that almost like when you meet a friend that you haven't seen for a long, long time, and they're telling you some traumatic event that's happened to them that you didn't know anything about. It was almost like that with Beth. It's almost like she was sitting next to me narrating this, and then this happened, and then, oh my God, and then, you know, like that. Whereas Carmel's in the present tense, and that seemed appropriate too, because she's very much more in the moment.
Carmel says she finds it easier to think of things as stories. I was wondering if writing the book was a way of dealing with your own kind of fears.
Oh, I think it always is. I think writing's great for that, actually. You put all the terrible sort of fears and worries and everything on the page. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Without wanting to give too much away, the narrative heads in a couple of unexpected directions, certainly unexpected for me. I'm wondering if you set yourself the challenge of surprising the reader.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I like being surprised as a reader myself. I didn't want to take this book on the path that you might think it would be taken. That was never in my mind to do that at all. So the story came to me pretty quickly. I mean, I didn't sort of deliberately set out to think, oh, what's going to be different and unusual and surprising or anything like that. But I was quite pleased that it was, because I do enjoy that myself in a book.
I'm wondering if plot and the surprises of plot are sometimes underrated in literary fiction these days.
Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, you know, I think it does make you turn the page. I mean, it is on a very basic level of wanting to know what happens. I mean,
and that's kind of part of the basic job, is it?
Yeah, well, I think so, yeah. For me, that's one of the things I really look for in a book, you know.
Children in the 21st century often wrapped up in cotton wool and denied that opportunity to explore the world for themselves that was afforded to earlier generations. Do you worry that writing a novel like this might contribute to that climate of fear?
Yes, I suppose so. Yes, I mean, anything does, I suppose. But I kind of really had to remind myself that I was writing fiction, I think, and writing about characters, you know.
But don't you think the stories that we tell also inform the way that we see the world around us?
Quite possibly, yeah. I think, actually, when I was writing it, I didn't really see it as a kind of news abduction story. For me, it was always more of a kind of Little Red Riding Hood fairy tale of a girl who's strayed off the path. So I think I perhaps saw it in a slightly different way.
Which isn't to say that fairy tales can't be terrifying
no,
in themselves.
True. Yeah, exactly. I mean, they've got all the elements there. But yeah, it was only after I finished, actually, that I thought, oh my goodness, she is Little Red Riding Hood, actually.
But you don't think that's kind of the writer's job to worry about those kind of wider issues? You've got to follow the story you've got.
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, we've all got responsibility, I suppose. With any story, there's going to be an element that you could worry about if you thought about it. And if you go down that route, you know, maybe you just wouldn't write anything because there would always be something that would worry you.
The Girl in the Red Coat is published by Faber. You can find more literary discussion on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on the Guardian Books website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. Thanks to Eula Biss and Kate Hamer. From me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Eva Krizyak, thanks for listening. For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.